Accession number 30284, reel 3.
Right, next bit, reel 3. So you moved onto the course that was still at RAF Prestwick, did you? That was the...
Yes.
Can you tell me how the course was organised?
Well, it was organised, again, with some more emphasis on the ground instruction side. We had to become fairly proficient at astro-navigation. To some extent, you can do that on the ground. I mean, all you've got to do is look at the sun or the moon or the stars or the planets and take an astro shot and then go back to your chart table and plot a position line. You can do that on the ground. You don't need to be in the air to do it. And you can take a whole series of these from different directions, and where they intersect is your position. You do that in the air under more difficult circumstances, because the aircraft to some extent is bouncing about, and it means that your shot is not so accurate as it will be standing steadily on the ground. So, but you did as much practice on astro navigation on the ground as you did in the air.
How do you take the shot?
Well, you have to look through the sort of aperture of the sextant and move it up and down until the star or the planet or the heavenly body, as we used to call it, appears in the aperture on the in the centre. And then what happened with the old type of sextant, you took, I think, 6 shots, click, 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 like that, because the thing is moving all the time. And you had to have your time to the exact second. And with the later ones, it happened automatically. You pressed the trigger, and it operated for 2 minutes, and you took the central time as being the most accurate. So you normally had to take shots of 3 heavenly bodies, and where they intersected, the position, you took them from different angles or a quadrant, and where they intersected was your position. But, of course, when you were in the air, you were moving. Thus, you had to move those position lines along to one time. In other words, if the whole procedure took 6 minutes, you would have to move the first one along by 6 minutes of time, not only time but distance. And again, you got what used to be called a little cocked hat. It was a little tiddly triangle, and then you put your pinpoint in the middle of that triangle, and that was your position. And you could usually reckon in the air to get your position within about 5 miles, which wasn't too bad, really, but it did need a lot of practice. It didn't come easily. Not only did you need the knowledge of the constellations, but you needed to practice how to operate the sextant in a moving platform when the aircraft maybe wasn't completely stable. And you even though it was maybe bucking up and down, you had to keep the star in the middle. But I became adept at doing that, and was quite proud of myself, I suppose, in being able, to position myself. Now, it so happened I didn't use it on... You needed an astrodome. The astrodome was optically true, so that there was no deflections in the glass which might affect the calculations. But on the ground, you didn't need, obviously, an astrodome. You didn't have this little additional problem. So all that was part of the training.
In navigating an aircraft from one place to another, would you navigate occasionally by use of the ground or the elements on the ground, would you ever navigate an aircraft that way?
Yes, of course you would. But when much of the navigation took place over the sea, and you could only do it by what was called dead reckoning, and that meant that you had to draw a track on a chart, which is called a Mercator chart, Mercator being a type of projection, to the objective. Then you had to navigate along that line using your knowledge of the wind velocity, which would give you a course to fly to proceed along that track. It was called a triangle of velocities. You need to know the wind speed and direction. You needed to know the direction of the track, and from that you had, by geometry, to calculate which course you needed to fly to arrive at that position. But it wasn't quite as easy as that, because once you had that course, there were two things that were needed to use for adjusting. One was the magnetic variation of the Earth underneath, which varied, and you had to look at your chart to see what the magnetic variation was and apply that to your course, give it to the pilot. Then, even then, the pilot had to make a minor correction because the aircraft itself suffered from magnetic attraction, and it used to be swung every now and again on various positions to show you what the deviation was. It wasn't very large, maybe 2 or 3 degrees, and he would have a little chart in front of him, and he would have to apply the deviation to the magnetic course which you gave the pilot. So you needed in the air to do all this sort of stuff and to keep a very cool head while you were doing it.
You mentioned there was another thing that you needed to be aware of. You mentioned the magnetic deviation, but there was also something else.
The magnetic influence of the Earth plus the magnetic influence of the aircraft. The two things needed to be applied to the course which you'd calculated before the aircraft could be moved along that path on the pilot's compass.
In dead reckoning, how do you factor in, say, changes in wind speed or direction? Is there any way that you can do that?
Yes, you could. You could look at, we had a bomb site, and you could look at the ground underneath you and twiddle the bomb site so that the lines of the bomb site coincided with the what was happening on the ground underneath you. And that would give you an angle between the aircraft's nose, so to speak, and the slightly different track it was following. Because the aircraft seldom flew along a straight track. It moved sideways to a minor extent, maybe about as much as 12 degrees or thereabouts. In other words, it didn't go in the direction in which it was pointing because the wind shifted it in another direction. So these were things you had to calculate. And you had to do it in the air. And you either... You couldn't do it over... you couldn't make these adjustments if you were above cloud. But if you were over sea or over land and could see the sea and the land, you could do it.
What would you focus on over the sea?
Wave tops.
Would you have to pick a specific one, or would you?
No, you could always do it. You could always do it. There was another thing on the on the surface of the sea, which it showed you the direction of the wind. If you look at a wave, there are like oily tracks going at right angles to it, and they gave you the direction of the wind. You don't realise that until you're in the air, but it is the case. When you look down on the surface of the sea, you can see, at least if you're low enough, you can see these oily tracks which give you the wind direction.
I imagine, though, in a situation like that with Dead Reckoning, the problems would occur with adverse weather or problematic... You mentioned you can only do that below cloud level. What happens in a situation when it's when you're in cloud or the weather's bad? What would you do there?
Well, that, of course, was the one of the factors which caused an enormous amount of aircraft losses, and that was crashing into sides of hills and into cliffs and so on. If you made a miscalculation, this could be the effect. It was, in many ways, even on operations, one of the most difficult things a navigator had to overcome. It was extremely difficult because and there was no real way out of this. If what you had was low stratus cloud. Now, if you were not over the sea and tried to descend through that low stratus cloud, you'd hit something. And it happened maybe, I mean, I don't have an accurate figure, but in those days for possibly 10% of the casualties that occurred in the RAF were due to navigational error of that sort. If you wanted to come down through stratus cloud, you had to come down over the sea and get underneath it and then come in. And, you know, people didn't take that method. They tried to get down through it again and again and again. And you get sea fog too. I mean, you could stand on the cliffs and see sea fogs coming into the cliff, and they'd cover the ground too. Then you were really stuck. I mean, you were stuck up there. There were occasions later on, as I will relate to you, when you almost on the point of bailing out because you couldn't find your way down through cloud if it clamped when you're up in the air. It was one of the major hazards, and one of the reasons why the navigator was, or air observer, was a fairly important member of the crew, because the pilot depended completely on him to make these calculations.
If you descended through the cloud, would you then try and get a visual fix as to where you were in some form?
Yes, but of course cloud is in layers. You could come down through one layer of cloud and there'd be another layer underneath you. But you'd have to get down through the lowest layer. And with any luck, I mean, you don't normally get stratus cloud right down on the deck. You could come down over the sea and pick up your wind speed and direction and come in below that low stratus cloud until you came to the coast. Then you would have to use your ability for map reading to see where you were, because you only had a rough idea of your position and you had to pick it up pretty quickly. So you had to be very good with map reading. I can show you all the maps of the British Isles. I've got them in there at the moment. But that was another facility at which I happened to be very good at map reading.
You say you were good at it. What gives you that skill? What are the things that give you your ability to read maps?
Well, first of all, you had to have a fairly accurate idea of where you might be. But then you had to look at you had to look from air to ground and ground to air all the time to identify a coastline, the position on the coastline. If you got that position wrong, then you were in trouble. You wouldn't get back to your airfield. You had to be sharp-eyed. I was very lucky in that respect. I'm no longer like that. I've got macular degeneration of one eye. But in those days, I had very sharp eyesight. And even better, for this is only accidental, I had extremely good night vision. This was tested and found to be exceptional. I don't know why I've got exceptional night vision. It still is pretty good, but I did have that. They stuck me in front of a sort of apparatus in which they kept reducing the light and shining objects on it, and I kept on identifying those objects, and they were so surprised they called other people in to what's this prowess, and they couldn't believe that I would say, well, that's a destroyer, that's a so and so and so and so, but I could pick them out. I don't know why, just something I was born with, I suppose. Very good night vision, and I could therefore identify stuff in half light or in complete darkness better than most other people. That's just luck. It's nothing to do with me. It just happens to be there.
What factor does the aircraft speed play in navigation?
Well, it does, of course. I mean, you have what's called a triangle of velocities, and that triangle is the track, the airspeed and direction, the wind speed and direction, and they form a triangle of velocities which enable you to fly along the track you want to fly. You have to be able to work that out, but there's a little instrument called a course speed calculator which does it quickly for you. So all these things you had to do, you had to keep a completely cool head and concentrate on little geometric problems when you were in the air.
How was the aircraft speed determined? Was it actually from the instrument?
Oh, yes. You would have to give the... You'd have to know what speed the pilot wanted to fly. And you'd have to liaise with him about speed. He'd normally fly at economic cruising speed. But that, of course, did vary again according to height. The higher you went, the faster you went, so to speak. So all those had to be little calculations in the air. In fact, there were a lot of tiny little calculations in the air all the time. And you had to be good at it, and you had to keep your head all the time. That was the most important thing. You had to keep calm. And
Was it a sustained, concentrated period for you as a navigator then?
Well, not on the practice flights, because they weren't very long. They were only about 3 hours. But yes, to fly for very long periods, you could lose your concentration. And this is one thing which has occurred to me in later life in trying to find out what happened to people who got lost. I think the navigators lost their concentration and made mistakes. If you flew for, say, 16 hours, as, say, Amelia Earhart did, a navigator using astro navigation for 16 hours, it'd be almost impossible to keep your concentration going for that period of time, I think. And that's why she got lost. Or people don't seem to realize that. They think it's some sort of pilot error. But it wasn't, it was a navigational error.
While you were training in the Avro Anson. Could you describe to me what a training flight would be like?
Well, you had an instructor with you, and you were told you had to fly to a certain point, go to another point, and then back again. Maybe you had to take some shots of the sun when you were doing it, and in the air, and the navigator, the instructor would sit there while you did it and worked on your chart, and then on your identification on the ground, pinpointing, as we used to call it, on the ground, as to how well you coped with it all. But of course the instructor was there in case you made a mistake and put things right. We had to watch you while you were doing it all the time, and you had to produce your log, right in the log, you know, all the stuff that you calculated and so on, which is available for inspection when you got in.
And would you be on your own, or would there be a number of pupils doing so?
No, there was only a single person, I think. Just a moment. I'm trying to remember. I think in the Anson we might have had two at various times, with one instructor and a pilot. But I think at that stage we might have had two occasionally, or one sometimes. Perhaps two to begin with, then as things went on, we'd have one, just one at a time. You had to pass out, so to speak, as a navigator, not only from your proficiency on the ground, but as your proficiency in the air, too.
What were, as a navigator, while you were training, what were the tools of your trade? What would you have with you?
I'd have a course speed calculator, which I can show you here. I would have dividers, pencil, little sharpener for my pencil. You didn't use ink in the air, of course. You couldn't use ink in the air, because as you went up further with a fountain pen, the pen would leak and you get it all over your uniform. So you left your fountain pen at home, you went up with a pencil, a protractor, a divider, and a course speed calculator, a Mercator's chart, your various maps. You'd have your helmet, and the helmet would plug in to a receiver, and you'd have a little switch on the mouthpiece, and that would, you'd switch it on when you wanted to talk to a pilot, and you have to say, "Navigator to pilot," and he'd say, "Okay, what is it?" And you'd have to say, "So and so and so and so." Then you, even that wasn't considered right. You'd have to pass him, if you wanted an alteration, you'd not only tell him over the intercom, you would pass him a little bit of paper which got it on, a little scrap of paper, which had the alter course so and so and so and so on it, things like that. So you'd have to go through all this routine.
Could you describe to me the course speed indicator, what it is and what it does?
Well, the course speed calculator, first of all, it has an airspeed, and airspeed, by sliding this thing up and down here, it has a wind speed and direction, which is this little thing here. You twiddle the dial round until you've got your track registered there, and then you read off whatever course the little triangle of velocities tells you. From then on, you'd have to work out, look and see what the magnetic variation was and what the aircraft deviation was. Then you had the course to fly. And, of course, you'd have to work out how long you wanted to fly for, whatever speed. And you'd know that after a certain number of hours or minutes, you'd have to make an alteration of course to some other position. It would start all over again.
And how experienced were your instructors?
Well, they seem to be people who've been active navigators and pilots who were perhaps past their prime, because most pilots and navigators were pretty young, and were moved on to the instruction side. There were also a number of civilians who gave talks to us as well. I think that occurred mostly on the meteorological side. So, you know, it was the instruction course was pretty good. It was pretty thorough, I think. But that wasn't the only thing as an air observer one had to do. You had to become, you had to do bomb aiming and air gunnery as well.
Can we just have a little chat before we go on to the air gunnery and the bomb aiming? A little bit about the meteorology again. Again, to what degree of knowledge did you have to understand about the clouds, and what type of clouds would you be?
You had to identify all types of cloud. You had to be able to read a synoptic chart. You had to know what a synoptic chart was, a weather map, if you like. It's sort of a more complex version of the sort you see on television now occasionally, on certain programs anyway. You would have to know what happened with warm fronts and cold fronts, other forms of extreme weather, and generally speaking, to be able to interpret the synoptic chart when it was shown to you. Of course, before you took off, you would always have a briefing on the weather conditions when you were flying, so you knew more or less what to expect. Nevertheless, you did need to apply that knowledge in the air, because it didn't always work out quite as you imagine, and the weather over England, Britain generally, more particularly perhaps up in Scotland, is very variable indeed. Weather can change, as you know, dramatically, and you'd have to be prepared for it as well. But you'd have to know what a cumulus nimbus cloud was, what a nimbus cloud was, what a fair weather cumulus looked like, and stratus cloud was like, and stratocumulus, and all that sort of stuff. You'd have to be able to identify these clouds and know what type of weather they represented too. You'd have to realize when you could get into sleet, which would form ice on the aircraft, for example, on the wings of the aircraft, which could be disastrous. I mean, that could bring you right down and crash if ice formed on the wings. On the fuselage and the wings, you have to be careful of avoiding that. And that could happen even in summertime if you flew into a cumulonimbus cloud. It could happen if you're high enough. And your aircraft would be tossed about all over the place like a rag doll if you flew into the wrong sort of cloud.
So would you, as a navigator then, keep your eye on the weather throughout the flight?
Of course. Of course I did. I would not only work on the chart table with all my instruments, I'd keep looking out all the time. You know, it was, you'd have to do two or three things at once. You'd have to be adept at it. You would never allow yourself to concentrate wholly on the chart table. That would be stupid of you. You'd have to look out. Of course, in operations, you had to look out for all sorts of things, but no, in ordinary navigation, you would have to keep your eye on the sea, if you could see the sea, on the weather, and be wary of what might come your way or you would come into.
Would you share information with the pilot and other crew members?
Without doubt. Not so much with the other crew members, although they could hear what you were saying to the pilot anyway. If you talked to the pilot, it would automatically go to the wireless operator and air gunner, so they would know what was going on and be able to take account of it. But most of the conversation that went on normally in an aircraft was between navigator and pilot. But of course there were occasions when the wireless operator would have to chip in too, but he would also tend to pass things through a little note, get out of his seat and give them to the pilot, or maybe there'd be a co-pilot there, but the air gunner would normally remain in his turret at all times. He wouldn't get out of his turret ever.
Would they be able to help you in any form of navigation? Were there any elements that the wireless operator or the air gunner could help you?
Very rarely. I mean, obviously the wireless operator might receive a message from base about weather conditions back there. That happened quite often, that you would be advised that the weather had clamped down in your home base and you had to go somewhere else. That didn't happen much in training, but it certainly did in operations, that you were told on the way back that don't get down here, you've got to go to some other place to land.
During the training period, you said it didn't occur much at that period. While you were under training, was the weather taken into consideration for training flights? Would they cancel it or suggest another area to train?
Yes, you wouldn't normally fly in adverse weather when you're training. It would be silly to do so. To begin with, it wouldn't help you very much in the training procedure. It could be somewhat dangerous, I suppose, until you'd really qualified and were used to things.